This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture, with me, Neil Denny. This week, writer and activist Julie Bindle on her new book, Straight Expectations, What Does It Mean to Be Gay Today? Julie Bindle is a freelance journalist, broadcaster and feminist activist. She is the co-founder of the law reform organisation Justice for Women. She is named in the World Pride Power List as one of the most influential lesbian and gay people in the world. Her first book is Straight Expectations, What Does It Mean to Be Gay Today? So Julie, welcome to Little Atoms.
Thank you.
Tell us about this book. I'm actually quite surprised to see this was your first book. But what's the idea behind it?
Well, I came out as a lesbian in 1977 and things were pretty horrendous. I was a teenager. We were not gay friendly. We had no legislation to support us at all. And then fast forward to 2014, where we have full legal equality with heterosexuals, where we can now take people to court for discriminating against us. And I wanted to have a look at whether or not culture had caught up with legislation. Mm-hmm. Because my feeling was, before I did the research for the book, was that we have a huge gap at the moment between legislation and attitude and society. And I did find out through the course of researching the book, through the huge survey that I conducted, that that is in fact the case. Bigotry is still alive and well. We have made huge advances, but in a way, they're almost appeasements. Mm-hmm. We're almost capitulating to those that have made it obvious that they don't really accept us. They tolerate us. And I, of course, don't want to be tolerated.
Of course. So we'll look more closely at the survey aspects of the book when we get into the second part. But as you just mentioned, I mean, you're from coming out to now sort of really parallels almost the history of the gay liberation movement. It's probably not really accurate to describe it as gay liberation movement anymore. That's a rather old and militant description for it. But let's talk about that history. Let's talk about when sort of gay activism first started.
Well, in 1969, there were the Stonewall Riots, which Stonewall, a gay rights organisation here in the UK, was named after. And that was a very vicious police raid on a gay bar in New York. And at around the same time in the UK, late 60s, early 1970s, there were alternative people that may have been called hippies at the time. There were people who were getting into kind of flower power and the sexual revolution, much as it hadn't particularly been great for women, was in full flow. So people were talking about sex, sexual politics, sexual identity, things we do in bed. Mm-hmm. And it gave a kind of permission and a lead to those gay people who had been living in the closet. We can't forget, of course, that gay sex between men had been criminalised up until 1967. Mm-hmm. So by the time we got to the end of the 60s, early 70s, gay men and lesbians were really up for challenging the notion that we were mentally disordered, that we were freaks, that we were unsafe around children. Mm-hmm. And so although gay men had been criminalised and lesbians hadn't, we were treated appallingly in other ways. For example, if a woman had been living with a man and they had children together and she left for another woman, mm-hmm. she decided to become a lesbian, she would always lose her children if the husband applied for custody, even if he were violent. Mm-hmm. And I personally sat through court cases in the early 80s where I saw women lose their children simply for being lesbians. So yes, there was terrible discrimination, terrible oppression, and the origins of the gay liberation movement were very, very radical. We didn't just want to overthrow bigotry, but we, and I say we, even though I wasn't involved in the gay liberation days, but mm-hmm. as early radicals, we wanted to overthrow the whole system of heterosexual marriage, of the way we do relationships, of the way mm-hmm. we raise children, and look at what true liberation for men and women would be. And interestingly, it was very pro-feminist, mm-hmm. the movement ethos, because the men within gay lib said, you know, we are also constrained by our gender roles, by mm-hmm. our sex roles. We are oppressed because we have grown up not wanting to be macho men who have sex with women and become the head of a family and work in a kind of conventional male job. We're different. And we support feminism because what feminism is saying is exactly the same, that sex roles oppress all of us, mm-hmm. and that we need to challenge those sex roles. So feminism and gay liberation were indivisible. And there was a really interesting line from Jill Tweedy, the Guardian columnist, very influential journalist, who wrote in the 1970s, in the early 70s, in support of gay liberation, that it's obvious that the gay liberation movement wanted to overthrow the kind of patriarchal system of marriage rather than join the patriarchal system of marriage. And of course, today we have a very different situation.
And that's something we're going to get onto later as well. But you've sort of talked about, described the early days as being, you know, the gay liberation movement and feminism as having the same goals. But it seems that quite early on, and this moment we're talking about, really, gay liberation to mean gays and lesbians. And I mean, beyond the political aspects of the movement, those two groups of people have quite different aims and needs, and quite early on there's really a divergence, isn't there?
Well, at first, of course, lesbians and gay men worked really well together, but soon the cracks began to show. And although some of the men in gay liberation had said that they supported feminism and wanted to do gender differently, in other words, not conform to the stereotypes, it soon became obvious that they expected the women to make the tea. Mm-hmm. Some of them would come in and start talking about the public sex they'd been having quite gratuitously, in quite an offensive way. It seemed that the priorities for some of the gay men were about cottaging and cruising, cross-dressing, which the lesbians who were feminist found offensive. Not all, but most. And some men would think that a way to show their support for feminism was to sit there and knit, which none of the feminists ever did in those days. So while those women were just casting aside all of what they would call the insignia of our oppression, dresses, knitting, that kind of thing, the men were getting into it. And so there was a split. It was gradual, but then pretty much all of the lesbians left the GLF and started to work autonomously.
I want to bring in then yourself and your own story into this thing, because as I said, it sort of parallels this whole history as well. So before we get up to what the concerns of the gay movement is nowadays, let's go back to when you first came out and tell us about your background a little bit and what that was like.
I was born in the northeast of England into a working class community. We lived on a housing estate. It was very much a kind of white, traditional northeast community. And the pickings were not, let's say, the most attractive for me in terms of boyfriend material. You know, it was expected that I would marry a local boy and we would have children and I would work in some kind of factory or shop. And, you know, our school was terrible. When I was 15, it became obvious that I had a crush on my best friend at school. And although I didn't identify as a lesbian, I was outed as one. And it's interesting, then, far more than now, even, girls were either lesbians or sluts. Mm-hmm. We were lesbians if we rejected the advances of boys. We were sluts if we had sex with them. Mm-hmm. I was actually genuinely a lesbian, and I hadn't particularly had boyfriends because I wasn't really interested. So I assumed all girls had crushes on other girls. So I was outed, and it wasn't my choice. But seeing as I was, I decided that I would be out and proud. I'm not sure what really led me to do that, but I was so angry at the names I was called, the fact that I lost all of my friends literally in one day, the fact that, you know, I'd been told by my babysitter that I couldn't watch The Naked Civil Servant that had been on a year or so before because it was deviant and hideous and I had to go to bed instead. So I suppose it all came out in one rush of disillusionment, and I decided that that's what I would be, that I was perfectly happy to be a lesbian. And that, you know, that was going to be my future.
You talked about you didn't identify as a lesbian until you were basically outed. And I'm asking this now because later on in the interview, we're going to talk about the idea of whether you're born this way, whether or not you choose a certain outcome. So what was that situation like? You come from a working class northeastern background. So did you not identify as a lesbian because you weren't necessarily aware that that concept even existed? You know, to Nate, you weren't aware that there was a thing to call it, rather than that you weren't a lesbian until you decided to be one because you were outed as one, if you see what I mean.
I was aware of the concept of lesbian because there'd been a TV series called Rock Follies, mm-hmm. which was fantastic 70s telly. And one of the singers, Rula Lenska, was in, and I think Julia Coveney, mm-hmm. and one of the characters, Covington, that's right, and she appeared to be a lesbian. Mm-hmm. And how we knew that was that she wore mismatched earrings. Mm. That was a real signifier. So while the kind of pinky ring and all the rest of it was working overtime mm-hmm. as a signifier for working class lesbians, the kind of more feminist alternative ones had the mismatched earrings. And I can't remember how I knew that, but probably it was kind of covertly discussed on the programme. But the reason why I didn't identify as a lesbian was because it was such a horrible word. And it's why I absolutely refuse to ever call myself or any other woman gay. Because mm-hmm. lesbian is a difficult word because of the meaning that was ascribed to mm-hmm. it. It's a perfectly ordinary word. And as we know, people who were born on the Greek island of Lesbos should actually be called lesbians themselves, mm-hmm. but not able to because we've co-opted the word. Now, had the Greek islanders decided that they would be called lesbians, it would be no worse a word than someone from Yorkshire. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is absolutely the meaning that was ascribed to it. And I remember people talking about lesbians as absolutely filthy and perverted. So that's why I rejected the term. And I just thought, well, I've fallen in love with my best friend and I must be one of those people.
I'm John Grindrod. You're listening to Resonance FM. And this is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
So let's carry on with the history that's going on at this time as well. So 1967 is the time when homosexuality men is decriminalised. And obviously there's another 40 years to go until we get to where we are now. And we're going to go through the 80s now. We've still got the 80s to come. And of course there's two key events in gay history, which is first of all AIDS and then Section 28, that terrible piece of legislation. So what difference did AIDS make to the gay movement?
Well, interestingly, just before the AIDS pandemic hit, one of the polls on social attitudes carried out in Britain showed that, I think it was about 2/3 of people thought that it was okay-ish to be lesbian or gay, that homosexuality was less of a problem than it had been 10, 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. So things were moving in the right direction. Mm-hmm. Then AIDS hit, and of course we're in the middle of a Thatcher government. So people, you know, the left was being dismantled, people were driven to a more kind of callous view mm-hmm. of others or those oppressed or in need or different. And of course the so-called public health warnings that were disseminated on TV and billboards and radio, etc. by the government were horrific. They were suggestive that AIDS was almost a punishment mm-hmm. for having gay sex, that it was dirty anal gay sex that was the root of it, that it was God's will, that it was God's punishment. And so in that climate, what you had was a huge backlash towards gay men and to an extent lesbians. So the response towards gay men from the general public, of course, was based on the misinformation that had been given by this awful public information campaign. Mm. And I think never in decades there had never been anything quite so poisonous and vitriolic towards one particular community. So that brought about a terrible fear of lots and lots of gay men and some lesbians, because they were being targeted, there were gay men being beaten up in the streets, mm-hmm. they were being refused admission to pubs, no one wanted to share a glass with them, they were being kept out of public toilets because people thought you could catch AIDS from a toilet seat. And one response to that was a great militancy in campaigns such as ACT UP, where groups of gay men and lesbian allies would line the roads and stop the traffic, trying to just get through to people that this misinformation was costing lives. And of course the other response was to hide away and to say, please don't do this. We just want to be left alone. Our friends are dying. We're terrified of catching HIV ourselves. Mm-hmm. So of course the climate was ripe for Thatcher to introduce Section 28, because when a book called, it was a book about two gay dads, I think Jenny Lives With Ian and Martin, and it was a book that was just about gay parenting that was found mm-hmm. in a library. Mm-hmm. And the teacher that found it went absolutely berserk, saying that this meant that propaganda, mm-hmm. pro-gay propaganda, was infiltrating all of the schools, that it was hideously perverted to see a little girl in bed with two men, despite the fact that they were her dad's. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, Dame Jill Knight, who was a terrible bigot, drafted Section 28, which basically just put the kibosh on any teachers talking about being gay or lesbian in a positive light. So you could speak about being gay, you could speak about homosexuality and lesbianism, but only if it was in a negative light.
Mm-hmm.
So those two things combined to, again, do two things. One response that came mainly from gay men, which was, leave us alone, we can't help it, we were born this way. Gay children are assigned their gay identity at birth, so therefore by the time they're in schools they're already gay. Therefore, if you can't teach children positives about being gay, you're directly oppressing them. Lesbians just went absolutely hell for leather and decided that they would take measures against this pernicious legislation by doing things like abseiling down the House of Lords chamber and chaining themselves to Sue Lawley's chair when she was reading the news live on BBC. So I'm generalising because, of course, there were some gay men that were terribly radical and there were some lesbians who just wanted to be left alone. In the main, the split was between the gay men who said, we can't help it, we're born this way, you must give us our rights, and lesbians who said, right, enough is enough. We are being maligned, this is bigotry, and we are not going to stand for it.
So what happened between then and now then is still, again, it's another 20 years, but clearly attitudes changed. We're now in a position, as you said, where, you know, the poor, innocent, bigoted B&B owners can't even ban gay people from staying in their
I don't know why any self-respecting gay man would want to stay in a chintzy B&B, but that's another matter.
And legislation to stop any sort of discrimination in employment laws and things, and eventually leading to, you know, what has just recently happened, gay marriage. So what changed?
What happened after the AIDS pandemic and Section 28? Was the development of a politics of equality. So in other words, we put down our placards and became placatory. So we started to ask for things, and that thing was legislation. It was written in the statute book. It was, if you write in law that we can no longer be oppressed, this will end our oppression. And of course, that was a very naive view, because we've had equal pay legislation for decades and women are still paid less than men. You know, we've had anti-race discrimination laws, and of course, there are still black people being harassed and even murdered on the streets. Legislation's important, but it's not at all the whole picture. We stopped campaigning and we stopped trying to overthrow the system that was rotten, and we asked for a place at the table rather than saying that table is rotten to the core. And so we struggled on. Stonewall was founded in order to challenge Section 28. Stonewall, in my opinion, is a very useful organisation. It's done lots of good work, but it's conservative with a small c. You know, it cozies up to corporate sponsors. It's quite apolitical. It takes the line, or at least its last chief executive, Ben Summerskill, did, that we can't help it, we were born this way, therefore you need to give us rights and leave us alone. So that's how I think we focused on equality and saying that we wanted to be the same as heterosexuals, because that's what equality means, rather than, we've seen marriage failing, we've seen the abuse that goes on within nuclear families, we have seen how equality legislation isn't effective on its own. That's not what we want. We want to overthrow the system, and we want to liberate everyone from the constraints of that awful old-style hetero-patriarchal life. It didn't quite work like that.
Listening to Little Atoms, I'm Neil Denny, and today I'm talking to Julie Bindle, and we're talking about her book Straight Expectations: What Does It Mean to Be Gay Today? Julie, we've been talking in the first part about the idea that social attitudes might have changed to go along with the legislative changes that have happened over the last 45 years. And as you mentioned, you've done quite significant surveys for this book looking at the social issues. And so I want to spend the first part of this second part of the show talking about those surveys, and specifically around the idea of, well, I'll say homophobia. But before we do that, you talk in the book about how there are problems with the use of the word homophobia, perhaps.
Yes, there are problems. I mean, first of all, homophobia actually usually only applies to gay men. And it's in the same kind of way that lesbians are happy to be just lumped in and be called gay, which erases really our specific issues that we have, which is that we're obviously very seriously affected by sexism as well as anti-gay, anti-lesbian prejudice. But I'm absolutely sick and tired of the overuse and the misuse of phobia, because it medicalises a social problem. It suggests that it's an illness. And, I mean, phobics now put onto everything. It's a lazy way of discussing having a problem with something. Now, people that have a problem with lesbians or gay men, people who don't like lesbians or gay men, they obviously can range from bigots to people who are quite ignorant. I don't notice there's anything phobic at all about their prejudice or their ignorance. And speaking as someone who has a proper phobia against rats, I know that it's a very different sentiment. I want to not feel like that towards rats. But I know that people who are anti-gay and who are seeped in prejudice get there through very different means.
So let's talk about whether or not, as I just mentioned in that introduction, legislation has changed over the last 45 years. So let's talk about the social attitudes. When you've been talking to people, doing these surveys, you've done surveys of both heterosexual and homosexual people. So presumably in this instance, we're going to be talking about the surveys of heterosexual people. What sort of attitudes have you found?
Well, there are some people who say that they did have gay friends, but since they had children, they don't have gay friends anymore. Now, that could be because they think that gay people don't have children, and increasingly we do, and that their lifestyle changes and they become further entrenched into their heterosexual lifestyle that seems to preclude those of us that aren't heterosexual. So that kind of gives a sense that it may be that gays and lesbians are all right to hang around with when you're kind of young, free and single and you're being a bit hip and groovy. But when you have a proper family, you know, you want to hang out with other proper families. In the main, the majority of the 4,000 odd heterosexual respondents seem to have quite positive attitudes towards lesbians and gay men on the whole. But it's not scientific. The surveys were put on The Guardian and then gay blogs and magazines. So there's no way that they're representative. The point of the survey, which brought 9,500 respondents across the two surveys, was to test the mood music in the UK, was to look at what people thought of issues such as, are we born gay? Do you support equal marriage? Have you ever experienced a homophobic attack? For the straight people, have you ever witnessed others experiencing, you know, an anti-gay, violent, abusive assault upon them? And it was really just to have a look at what the priorities are for both straight people and gay people for the future. And the overwhelming sense that I got, certainly from gay men and from most straight people, was that our work is done. There's nowhere else to go. Yes, we still need to tackle anti-gay bigotry in schools, because, for example, the Stonewall report that came out recently on young people and the use of the term gay as a pejorative found that over 90% of young people in schools had used that word as a pejorative. So there's obviously much work to be done. But the surveys were interesting in that it showed how people automatically, pretty much if they're a good liberal, believe in equal marriage and believe that we are born that way. But there is a difference between lesbians and gay men, on the other hand, where lesbians were less likely to think that we were born gay, more likely that it could be a positive choice in a social construction. But interestingly, we found that more than 70% of gays and lesbians had at some time in their lives, so not necessarily recently, suffered an anti-gay attack. 20-odd percent of those people had suffered a violent physical attack. So obviously, when you think about how we've got to where we are today, that really would shape us. If the majority of those polled had experienced direct anti-gay prejudice and bigotry or even violence, then it really can knock the kind of campaigning zeal out of you. You're far less likely to want to be identified on the street.
And you do talk in the book about how a lot of these attacks are by quite young people, which is not the direction you would have expected. We would have thought that people, the younger people are, the more tolerant they would be, perhaps.
And I think that we've gone backwards in some ways. And I'm not sure why, but I think that in lots of ways we've gone backwards with social movements. I mean, if you look at what feminism has fought for an end to the sexual exploitation through imagery mm-hmm. of young girls and women. We're now seeped in this laddish culture where the kind of pornography that I would find under my brother's bed back in the 70s is now what we see on MTV. Mm-hmm. So I think that we've gone backwards in terms of equality for women and girls. Why then would it not be the case mm-hmm. that we've also gone backwards in accepting men who do not fit the masculine norm? We've got such a macho culture amongst many young men at the moment. And it's kind of, it's a little bit risque but trendy to say that it's young black men, men from African and Caribbean heritage. It's across the board. It's young men per se. And I think that we've really lost the ability to challenge some of that machismo because white liberals do think it's a cultural norm of some other communities and therefore we're leaving it well alone.
You mentioned a few times the idea of people being, you know, this idea of born this way, the fact that a person is designated gay from birth. Now, this is something that you take exception with.
I think it's cowardly capitulation for those that should know better to say, give us our rights, pass this law, because we are born this way, we can't help it. Well, some of us want to be lesbian or gay. Some of us are perfectly happy. When you hear these people that are wedded to innateness, immutability about sexual preference, they only really ever look at whether or not it's innate for lesbians and gay men. No one ever looks at the causes of heterosexuality. But when I hear that particular drum being banged, it makes me want to say, what about those that come out later in life? What about bisexuals? Is there a specific gene or a specific biological basis to bisexuality? Why do we have to prove something is innate to demand our rights, to demand respect? Because, of course, being black is innate. Being born into the female sex is innate. But that hasn't stopped people hating us or legislating against us and not giving us our rights. So I don't want to have to pander to the bigots who say it's a lifestyle choice, therefore you can be cured. I don't want to have to then argue the opposite to them, to say, get off my back. I don't think that anything that I say or write in the book will ever please the bigots. So the fact that I say I'm an out and proud lesbian who wants to be this way, mm-hmm. that's not going to reassure them and think they can send me to conversion therapy. And I think it's a red herring that we worry about what the gay Christian conservatives and others that hate us say about how we can change. They don't know, they don't care whether there's a gay gene, whether we choose it, whether we're born that way. They don't care. They just want us to stop being it. And you can, of course, stop being it whether or not you want to and whether or not you still have the urges. So it's an absolute ridiculous obsession that we have. And when I was invited by the Wellcome Trust to do a Google Hangout, mm-hmm. a debate with scientists on the question of whether or not we are born gay, I was really shocked and disturbed to find that what had given them impetus for the programme was that they'd put out the question to 75 of their experts, many of whom were eminent scientists and other experts in the field. And they'd asked, what is the most important scientific question of today? Mm-hmm. And instead of it being how to cure cancer, how to find a cure for AIDS, whether or not we can cease global warming, what about population control, are there aliens in other planets? It was, are we born gay? Now, why this massive preoccupation? So we'll never prove whether there's an innate scientific basis for it. There's plenty of anecdotal evidence that it isn't. There are plenty of particularly lesbians who say all women should have the right to choose and determine our own sexuality, and it can be a positive advantage eschewing heterosexuality. But we'll never, ever have any evidence one way or another. I can't scientifically prove that there isn't a scientific basis to being lesbian or gay.
I'm Jeff Dyer. You're listening to Resonance FM, and this is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
But people are, I mean, scientists are looking for it. The very concept of a gay gene, which is obviously a vast simplification of it, but that idea is out there. And you're talking about this in terms of it as a rhetorical device when, you know, what's the best way to tackle bigots? Now, if those bigots didn't exist and gayness was innate, it still would be innate, you know. So,
yes.
So what you do talk about the science in the book. What is though? Who is looking for what? What is actually going on in that side?
Well, there's Kazi Rahman, who's an eminent biologist, academic, and he is determined to find two things. One is how we identify the biological basis, mm-hmm. and another is how you can recognise whether someone is lesbian or gay. He himself is a gay man. He is extremely well-intentioned and I've got no doubt has nothing but good motive. Mm-hmm. But I wonder if the reason he gave me for looking for innateness in sexual response is really sensible, which is that for some lesbians and gay men who are afflicted by self-hatred because of external forces, it would be a reassurance for them to know that 3% or 5% of the population have this particular chromosome or this innateness, because it removes the responsibility from them.
But that doesn't mean they're not going to still hate it.
Well, yes, and it also, I don't know why we can't actually prioritise eradicating bigotry and anti-gay prejudice and reassuring those young people with that.
We could do that if there was a bigotry gene. What I find most sinister about the concept of a gay gene is not that it's a thing that could be used to suggest that, well, you know, we're born this way, please be nice to us. But the opposite, that people will say, okay, well, you know, we can start aborting gay fetuses then if we know that this is the case.
Indeed. And I think if you ask any good liberal, what do you think about gays and lesbians? They'll say, oh, nothing at all. I don't have an issue. I don't have a problem, particularly now that they can get married just like ours. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're safer, we're contained. We also fall out in IKEA on a Saturday afternoon mm-hmm. and go to garden centres on a Sunday. So we're recognisable now as creatures rather than odd freaks. But if you gave them all a truth drug and asked, would they mind if one or all of their children decided to be lesbian or gay, turned out to be lesbian or gay? Mm. I think pretty much all of them would rather they didn't. So we're treated better. People are less prejudiced towards us if they're from that kind of liberal camp. But I don't think they want us necessarily to be in their family. If we end up in their families, if they're good people, they still love us, they still accept us. In fact, they make an effort to treat us no differently from anyone else. But I don't think that they would choose us.
So where then, and this is a ridiculously difficult question because my own belief is that every single individual, their experience and their origin story is unique. But where does then it come from, if not from some sort of innate biological?
Well, I think that lots of women and possibly men, although I'm definitely more ignorant about gay men than I am lesbians, I think the majority of women will develop a crush, post-pubescent crush, on a girl or even one of her mum's friends mm-hmm. when she's at school. It's kind of a rites of passage. If you look back to the 1920s and 30s, there were lots of school stories, Enid Blyton and the like, although not Enid mm-hmm. Blyton, but like her, where it was mandatory to have a crush mm-hmm. on a girl at school. You're talking about posh girls in fee-paying schools. But it was accepted. It was a total rites of passage. And then, of course, you met a man and you were married and then you straightened yourself out. But lots of straight women who were open have told me that, yes, of course they had a crush on a girl. Now, I had a crush on a girl. Now, what would have happened if I then had a crush on a boy after her? As it happened, I had a crush on a boy before I ever had a crush on a girl. And that was probably the last one ever. But if I had stayed in Darlington, if I had gone the way that I was meant to go, and women do live under compulsory heterosexuality, we do live under patriarchy, even though it's an old-fashioned term, mm-hmm. it's more difficult for us to not marry, to not settle down with a man, not have children. Then I would have been married, I would be heterosexual, I would possibly be very unhappy, but lots of women are, and I would put my crush on my school friend down to, that's what happens with girls. Mm-hmm. So what happened with me was that I decided I needed to leave Darlington. I love my family, still do, very close to them, but there was nothing there for me. And I was desperate to get involved in feminism. I'd seen something called Shoulder to Shoulder on TV, a TV series that was about the suffragettes. And I was desperate to be a feminist. I got really interested in it. Didn't read much. We weren't really a bookish family. But, you know, I started looking at magazines in W.H. Smith and realised that I could actually probably leave home and carve a life for myself. And by meeting feminists, in those days, in the late 70s, you were going to meet lesbians. Mm-hmm. Because most lesbians were feminists and most feminists were lesbians in the militant camp, which is where I was going. Mm-hmm. I was from a sun-reading family. I wasn't going to go half-bait liberal socialist feminism. I was going to go red-top feminism. So the feminists that I met were lesbians and they were talking about sexual liberation and said, you know, women are leaving their husbands. You know, they're realising that because we're fighting together on the barricades, you know, sometimes you fall in love when, you know, you're on some big demonstration, you get arrested, it's all very exciting, adrenaline's going. And I thought, my God, this is a great concept. They're actually talking about lesbianism as a really positive choice.
Mm-hmm. But in describing choosing lesbianism as a positive choice. Do you mean that in a, you know, in those days, a sort of a way to engender self-esteem, and or are you literally talking about a choice?
It's not a choice like, you know, what to have for dinner. And it's not an easy choice for anyone. But I think if you're able to explore a possibility, then the choice should be open to all women. I don't think all women should be lesbians. Mm-hmm. I think anyone should be happy to having whatever consensual sex that they want to have, as much as they want, as often as they like, with however many that they wish to have sex with. But women have been so oppressed and repressed for time immemorial, and obviously our sexuality is used to punish us, that the early mantra at the height of the women's liberation movement was, you know, women should determine their own sexuality, and if that means that you leave men behind, because actually what you've identified through your feminism is that men can be pretty, you know, foul, then that should be an option. I was in Sweden recently at a massive feminist conference of Scandinavian feminists mainly, but other international speakers, and there was a very famous Swedish lesbian, sort of like a mix between kind of Sue Perkins and, you know, Ellen DeGeneres or someone like that. And she'd written a book with another woman in Swedish, so she described it to me as the six-step program to becoming a lesbian. And she said it was only partly tongue-in-cheek. She'd written it because she was sick and tired, and I've had this a lot over the years, of straight women saying to her, oh my God, I'm so unhappy with Benny, whoever. I wish I was like you. I wish I could be a lesbian. And that comes out of feeling that there are some of us who are and some of us who aren't, and we're either born that way or we're not. And so the author said, well, but you can be. It's great. You know, take a trip around the corner. Try it. And so she's done this kind of quite funny six-step program of how to get over your prejudice. And how to stop telling yourself there are some women who are lesbians and the rest of us just have to put up with bad sex or rubbish men for the rest of our lives.
We talked in the first part about the terrible Section 28 legislation, and we didn't mention how it's often described, which is this idea of legislation against the promotion of homosexuality, which seems like such a stupid, ridiculous concept. How can you possibly do it? Yeah. But that is what we're talking about here, isn't it? We're talking about the promotion of homosexuality.
Absolutely. Oh, I mean, I used to have a badge. I wish I still had it. We recruit. And, you know, we always used to make jokes about lesbians, you know, being bothered by straight women in the movement, in the women's movement, who would be very excited at meeting lesbians, quite attracted to the idea. I think today you would call them bi-curious. And there would be lesbians saying, oh, she's really after you, but I don't do conversion jobs. That was quite a kind of regular gripe that we had, that, you know, these curious women who would go home to their safe husbands and their children at night thought that we were like exotic animals. But yeah, I mean, this is another reason why the Born This Way camp are so persuasive, because they appease people. So it's not catching if you're born that way. We'll never, ever grow beyond about 3% or whatever the estimation is. We can't really impose it upon anyone else or promote it as something good. But it's my job to promote lesbianism as a great thing. It doesn't mean that I actively recruit. It means that I say to people, we're not sad creatures who were born with a wonky chromosome, and therefore we put up with it and we make the best of it that we can. I think being a lesbian is fantastic. I think gay culture is wonderful. If I could flick a switch and be anything but me, I wouldn't dream of it.
I'm Rosa Rankin-Gee, and this is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
However, you say that, but I want to bring us on to talking about, you've mentioned it a couple of times, the idea of conversion therapy, which is, it seems quite a modern thing, and it's a disgraceful idea. And there's a great section in the book where you talk about going undercover and talking to some therapists. But if it seems to me that conversion therapy is terrible if you're born gay, because there's nothing you can do to change that, so conversion therapy is inherently wrong. But if you're talking about choosing, if you're talking about the possibility of choosing to be gay, then the opposite of that is a person who is gay one day deciding to choose not to be gay.
I think conversion therapy is appalling because it's trying to fix something that isn't broken. It's value-based therapy which should never be seen, given the light of day. It's based on bigotry and hatred. It follows a religious, fundamentalist religious doctrine that we are all made in God's image and that God is disappointed in us if we're anything other than the kind of Adam and Eve model. But conversion therapy is terrible for all of those reasons, not because it doesn't work. It doesn't work. It couldn't possibly work for me because I don't want to change, because there's nothing wrong with me.
But if you did want to change, if you came from a religious background that, You know, obviously you've grown up in an atmosphere that is constantly telling you that what you do is bad and sinful. So that's one thing. But at the same time, you could be a person who prioritises your religion and your, you know, your love for Jesus more than your love for your boyfriend.
Yeah.
So therefore would feel that you wanted to do something to not be this way anymore.
I think that our sexual identities are completely embedded in lots of ways until something happens that's quite life-changing. I mean, I hate certain types of comedy, but I don't have a genetic predisposition to hating certain types of comedy. You will never get me to like them ever. You know, there are some things that I am absolutely, you know, that ring my bell completely in terms of visuals, things that I enjoy doing with friends. There are things that I absolutely detest and hate. And I don't think that there's an innateness to that. I think it's something that's a mix of opportunity, of luck, of being in the right or wrong place at the right time, of meeting people who can really inform your choices. So I don't think conversion therapy could work at all because it's based on the premise that there's something broken that needs to be fixed. Now, whether or not you believe you're born that way or you've somehow made a choice, and I wish there was another word because it's not really appropriate, just whether you're born that way or not, I don't think that you would need conversion therapy to stop acting out as lesbian or gay if Jesus Christ was more important to you than your sexual responses or your love for another individual. You would deny yourself that pleasure. You would deny yourself that love, that relationship. And it's wholly sad and tragic. But nobody gets converted by conversion therapy. I've met several men and women now who've undergone it for real. Mm-hmm. I was there as an undercover journalist. And it didn't work for them. Interestingly, the women that I met, all of whom had been brought up in Christian fundamentalist households, didn't think or didn't care. Well, didn't think they were born that way and didn't care whether they were or not. They just knew that it was fed back to them as filthy, sinful, dirty, wrong. And so I just want to close the whole thing down, stop them from doing it, stop them from thinking there's anything wrong with being lesbian or gay, and us not have to use the excuse that they shouldn't do it because we'll never change. Because we were born that way. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't work.
And you met when you were undercover, you met some of the therapists as well. So what is the motivation of these people?
Well, I met one therapist and underwent therapy myself. The motivation is religion. It's based on an absolute horror and fear of same-sex attraction, as they call it. They won't use the term lesbian or gay. I went to one who specialises in female same-sex attraction. And I'm sure she's a very decent person in lots of ways. I'm sure that she's motivated by what she sees as love rather than hate. Now, I've been out as a lesbian for a long time and I'm very, very confident. I'm surrounded by support and I'm surrounded by affirmation of my sexuality. But just 4 days therapy depressed me, made me anxious. I had a panic attack. I was in role, so I wasn't even there as me. But in order to stop crying when she was talking about whether or not my mother had abandoned me, and that's one of the reasons why I turned out this way, in order to not cry in front of her, I had to imagine that my mother was Jeanette Winterson's mother in Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit, who is obviously a monstrous character, unlike my actual mother. I would go back to the hotel and, you know, just drink gin and watch Netflix. It made me question, not my sexuality, but question whether things had happened to me in my childhood that had sent me wonky. You know, had I been sexually abused? Because this is what they say. Mm-hmm. It's never for a good reason. It's never, or even something quite neutral like, well, you knocked your head and something got dislodged. It's horrendous stuff. It's a dominating mother. It's an absent father. It's sexual abuse. It's every negative reason why something goes wrong in your life. Mm-hmm. And I, of course, don't consider being lesbian or gay as something having gone wrong. But it was an awful experience.
I didn't mention that you went to America. This particular therapist you talked to was on a trip to America.
It was in Denver, Colorado, just outside Denver in a small town, which is walking distance to Columbine, where, of course, the massacre occurred. I think it's 20 years ago now, and where people have become much, much more religious than even before the Columbine tragedy. And they're sort of clinging to their faith in order to make sense of what happened. And so I think I walked past about 10 churches, you know, from my hotel to the therapy centre.
But this is something that's coming over here as well, is what I was going to get to.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it is here. A week after I came back from Colorado, I went to a conference run by an organisation called Core Issues Trust, which is UK-based. It's in the book. I talk about how there's one ex-gay man, Michael Davidson, perfectly affable, again, well-intentioned man, who himself was gay, underwent conversion therapy to stop his attraction.
You're saying he was gay, a formerly gay man you've just described him as. He is gay.
Yeah, well, I mean, he obviously isn't living the life of a gay man, so his identity is heterosexual. Mm-hmm. He has a wife and children. I don't want to put a value judgment on Michael Davidson. He's a good man. But I think he's just denying himself what he actually really wants to do, how he really wants to live. There are plenty of people here who practice trying to convert gays and lesbians from a Christian perspective. I think one of the surveys of all mental health practitioners in the UK found that 11,000 of them had either practiced therapy on a patient themselves or referred them to someone who would. What's really worrying and sick is that although conversion therapy is becoming less acceptable in America because of the gay lobby there saying, whoa, there's nothing wrong with us, it's becoming very popular in countries where homosexuality is criminalised or where there's dreadful, dreadful bigotry and violence and prejudice, such as in China, some parts of Southeast Asia, and of course in some African countries like Uganda. There are approximately 80 countries around the world currently that criminalise same-sex encounters or relationships. And of course, in some countries, the death penalty is imposed. You know, there are lesbians who've been given 50 lashes in public squares, you know, men who've been stoned to death and hung. So all around the world, we've got this terrible bigotry. And of course, we just have to look at Russia, which has gone backwards, as has India. Mm-hmm. So in some countries, you can see that the rights that have been hard won are being eroded. And it's not impossible that that would happen here, because we haven't won the hearts and the minds of anything more than, I think, a sizable minority. You could hear the gross bigotry that came out of some religious leaders' mouths during the debate on equal marriage, where we were likened to those that have sex with animals and children.
This is Little Atoms, I'm Neil Denny and I'm talking to Julie Bindle, and we're talking about her book Straight Expectations, What Does It Mean to Be Gay Today? And Julie, despite the way you just described the equal marriage debate in the House of Lords and what have you just before the break, we do now have the right, gay people do now have the right to be married. David Cameron no less, brought in this new right. So can I be expecting a wedding invitation anytime soon?
I definitely won't be getting the coronation chicken out and planning my first dance. You know, as a radical feminist, I'm anti-marriage. I'm not anti-equality. Of course it's wrong that you say to one group of people, you can't marry when the rest can. I mean, if you said to Jews, you can't marry, but you can have something called a civil partnership, and that's good enough for you, they'd rightly so be an outcry. So it's wholly wrong that lesbians and gay men were excluded from this institution, in the same way as it's wholly wrong if lesbians and gay men are excluded from adopting children or from joining the military. But what we have to look at, certainly as a feminist, this is my concern, that marriage is an irredeemable institution. It's built on oppression of women. It's built on inequality. It's about property ownership, and it privileges the few. And I would love to see the abolition of marriage and the introduction of civil partnerships for everyone. I don't want the state to interfere in my relationship. We've had that in the bad old days. I also don't want any link between my relationship and the church and the state. And obviously you can choose to be married and disentangle yourself from any religious ceremony. But this is ultimately what it's about. It's bad for women. I don't think that two women getting married in a lesbian ceremony will be patriarchal, but the institution is patriarchal. The huge amount of money that was spent on introducing this law could have been better spent. I think we could have better priorities. There are still things that we need to sort out before we start throwing the confetti. And as I say, I'm very pro-equality. It's unjustifiable that we were excluded from the institution. But it's provided a handy smokescreen. It's given many of us the impression that everything is sorted out. And it's absolutely right that Cameron should be the one to introduce it, because it's a very conservative institution. And he wants to contain us, he wants to make us tame. Mm-hmm. As I said before, he wants us to fall out in IKEA. You know, and I want to say to him, haven't we suffered enough? Why on earth do you want to drag us into a failing institution? One in two marriages, heterosexual marriages, fail. Many women cite domestic violence as a reason for filing for divorce. Children are damaged through relationships failing between their parents because divorce is so prevalent. Why do we want to get involved in that? In the old days, we wanted new ways to have relationships. Now, we're talking about the here and now. I get that. I'm not harking back to a golden age and romanticising it and being nostalgic about the old days. There was lots that was shit about the old days. Things are much better now. Mm-hmm. But this is not liberation. It's capitulation. And I wish that I had seen another response from the lesbians and gays when we were offered these crumbs from the heterosexual table. I wish that we'd said in a loud voice, stick your marriage. We don't want it. We want to do better than that.
But surely equal marriage it was a goal that was achievable, right? Well, the idea of overthrowing the entire patriarchal structure of
still
marriage...
Still working on it.
It's something, yeah, it's a nice dream. And that's something now we can all work on equally, because everybody can get married, right?
Well, I think that what we've done is that we've shored up marriage. I don't think that we have in any way subverted marriage. I think that marriage has made us tame. Mm. I think it's made us very straight. I think we were looking in the radical era. We wanted to do relationships differently. We wanted to overthrow the kind of complacency that had prescribed the nuclear family for women. Mm-hmm. Lesbians felt liberated from not having to have children. And now, of course, many lesbians are rushing towards mm-hmm. the sperm bank, IVF clinics, and even, you know, surrogate services, which I think is an abhorrent form of exploitation. Sourcing out your pregnancy. You know, this is becoming the norm. We're literally copying the heterosexuals. And yet heterosexuals know that they have miserably failed in many ways. And we were teaching heterosexuals in many ways to do their relationships differently. What's really interesting now is that many straight couples are moving away from that traditional model. Mm-hmm. So marriage is on the decrease amongst heterosexuals. We will shore it up, don't you worry. I mean, every single lesbian and gay man, I think, is heading, you know, for the kind of confetti.
It is interesting that the opposition to gay marriage was some sort of amorphous idea that it was supposed to in some way undermine the institution of marriage, and that marriage was between a man and a woman and that's what it was supposed to be about. Whereas I think you're absolutely right, whether or not I agree with it or not to the extent that you do, I agree entirely that what you're saying, that it's basically shoring up the institution of marriage. It means that everybody is co-opted into the same system.
Oh, yeah, I mean, marriage has been given a new lease of life. And remember, there's lots of money to be made from it. And Boris Johnson even said, you know, look, what gay weddings can bring to the economy of London. It's quite significant. Mm. You've got wedding planners, you've got, and tell me how this works, stag and hen do organisers. I mean, what does a lesbian couple do? Does the butch one go on the stag do and the femme one go on the hen do? I mean, I heard this appalling story of a lesbian couple being married that was so traditional that one half of the couple went off with her mates, watched gangster movies, smoked cigars, drank whiskey and played poker. I kid you not. Whereas the other half went to a spa with her friends and had her nails painted and drank pink champagne. I mean, what on earth is going on? So there's lots of money to be made up from marriage. It's provided a smokescreen. It's a little bit like having a royal wedding in the middle of a recession. It's given lots of people, straight and gay, the impression that we're sorted, that we're fine. And what we have actually been given is an entry to a club that we never wanted to enter. So you have, for example, a country club. You live in the Cotswolds. And they don't want you to join because you're a Jew or because, you know, you're a bit working class origin, you're a bit new money. And you try for years and they don't want you. All of a sudden, you're allowed in. What the fuck do you want to join that horrible club for? It's still based on inequality. It's still a horrible, scuzzy club. Why on earth would you want to join?
Well, I want to finish off then talking about, I guess, what you think has gone wrong with the movement. I mean, I guess we've been talking about that all the way through the interview, but this idea that now gay activism has been sort of co-opted into the mainstream and is not radical anymore. So what do you need to do to shake it up?
We need to look at what still needs to be done. And I think we all need to take responsibility. Now, I'm one of the privileged lesbians. There are many, many privileged gays and lesbians I know. By privileged, I mean I'm able to be out. I haven't been stopped from working. I have got a public voice and platform and, you know, a little bit of power here and there. I know people who know people who know people. So what we should be doing is saying, right, there are young, gay, working class kids growing up who have not got any of our privilege. Hopefully one day they will have. So what we need to do is take responsibility and fight those battles. You can't stop fighting just because it's been all right, it's been made all right for you. So as a 52-year-old lesbian in a middle-class profession, I now don't need to do any more fighting for me. Mm-hmm. But since when did that stop any people in radical social movements from continuing the fight? You didn't see it in the civil rights movement. You don't see it in the disability rights movement. You don't see it in the women's movement. You know, you don't see people giving up because things have been made all right for them if they're truly radical. Mm-hmm. We could root out 10, 12 priorities right now for the UK that we need to do. Overseas, even more. We need to be supporting gays and lesbians in countries where it's criminalised, where they're being attacked on the street. We need look no further than our own backyard for that, because it's also happening here. So I think we just need to get radical again. We need to stop this complacency. And we need to recognise that we're still not that popular. We're still not very well liked. We're still viewed with suspicion. I don't want to feel grateful anymore. And if I had one wish that could be granted overnight, I would wake up tomorrow and be assured that no lesbian or gay man would ever, ever ask for tolerance again. And would never, ever be satisfied with being tolerated. You know, we want to be welcomed and appreciated. We tolerate bad weather. We tolerate a boring movie. We tolerate back pain. I do not want to be tolerated, and I don't want any of my brothers and sisters anywhere in the world to ever use that word again, unless they're being critical about it.
And that's a perfect point for us to finish. So I have been talking to Julie Bindle, and we have been talking about her book, Straight Expectations, What Does It Mean to Be Gay Today?, which is out now from Guardian Books. So, Julie, thank you so much for talking to me.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by Neil Denny and was broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM.
You can find the Little Atoms podcast on iTunes, and you can follow the show on Twitter at Little Atoms.
If you'd like to donate a little money to support the show, you can do so at littleatoms.com. Thanks for listening.